a presentation of a proposal to investigate the occurrence of natural and anthropogenic hexavalent chromium and estimate background chromium concentration in Hinckley, California.
Good evening, Chairman and members of the board. My name is Ann Holden, and I'm an engineering geologist in the Water Board South Lake Tahoe office. And I'm just going to give some introductory slides for item two, which is the U.S. Geological Survey's proposal to investigate natural and anthropogenic chromium in the Hinckley Valley. And I just wanted to explain that currently the Water Board has adopted background values for chromium in Hinckley, and these were adopted in November 2008, based on data in PG&E's 2007 background study report. And there are average and maximum values adopted for total chromium of 1.5 and 3.2 parts per billion. And for hexavalent chromium, the average and maximum values are 1.2 and 3.1 parts per billion. And the Water Board uses these background values in several important ways. First and foremost, we use the maximum background values to define the chromium plume in groundwater and to assess remediation progress. So those the 3.1 and 3.2 part per billion values are used to draw the chromium plume boundary on maps, and then that also defines the whole house replacement water program area, which is buffered off of that plume line. Background is also used as the basis to set cleanup levels for the comprehensive cleanup of chromium in groundwater. We use the background values to evaluate the cleanup alternatives in the environmental impact report that was certified here in July of 2013 for the project. And then those background values were also used as significance criteria in the EIR, which would trigger mitigation measures if those values were exceeded in domestic wells. And they set the water quality requirement for chromium for any replacement water that would be provided as an EIR mitigation measure. So we use those, the background values are very important in our work. So tonight we're going to hear from the USGS on a new proposal to evaluate background values, and they're being reevaluated because back in March of 2011, here at a Water Board meeting, the board members heard some public concerns regarding PG&E's 2007 background study report. So the board directed staff to have that report peer-reviewed, and it was independently peer-reviewed by three different experts who identified some serious deficiencies in the background study report. So the existing background values are not fully credible. So in January of 2013, a technical working group, or TWG, has been meeting regularly to work on a new framework to develop a new study for evaluating background concentrations of chromium. And the technical working group includes members of the Hinckley Community Advisory Committee and its consultant, Project Navigator, Water Board staff, PG&E staff and their consultants, and also Dr. John Izbecki of the United States Geological Survey. So working with the TWG, Dr. Izbecki has developed a new study proposal, which he submitted in 2013. That draft proposal is in your agenda packet for item two. The TWG members, including Water Board staff, PG&E, and Project Navigator, have all reviewed and provided comment letters on that draft proposal, and those are as well in your agenda packet. So we've all discussed our comments and reviewed and agreed on the technical details of the study, and Dr. Izbecki is going to go ahead and present his study to you tonight. And so considerations for the Water Board. What we're bringing this for you to consider tonight is basically to get an indication of your support for Water Board staff to be involved in moving forward with the study. The study is going to take about 4 years, so the staff effort would include continued monthly to quarterly meetings in Hinckley as part of the technical working group, reviewing and providing interim comments on work products, We'll also need to develop a contract to fund this implementation of the study, which would be ongoing through probably the first half of 2014, and then managing that contract through the study, which should end in 2018. So just to give you an idea of the level of involvement that it would take. Okay, and with that, I will turn it over to Dr. Sutton.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members of the board, for the opportunity to present the results of the background study proposal to you. And we'll wait a second for it to come up. Does everybody have a copy of the slides?
Not yet. I'm getting handed out as soon as I get
the presentation. Thank you. So this proposal is to study the occurrence of natural and anthropogenic man-made chromium near a MAC plume in Hinkley, California, as Anne explained. That's actually got some very serious implications in terms of how you manage the plume and what you intend to do with it to clean it up. This small print on this slide may look like legal documentation. In a lot of ways, that's what it is, something that you sign on a small portion of a contract. But really, it was prepared under contract with the Lahontan Board, not with PG&E. I have been working for you for the past year in collaboration with your staff and the members of the CAC. And if you look, I've outlined the people who have been involved in this process, and includes the local citizens, your staff, Project Navigator, Pacific Gas and Electric Company. And in many ways, despite the technical complexity of the proposal, it was really a very easy proposal to write because all I had to do was listen. It was very clear in the minds of the community and very clear in the minds of PG&E what they needed to have known before they could pursue with this program and move forward. So I hope it really reflects their input and their concerns and their needs. A little bit of education. Chrome 6 does occur naturally in California groundwater. You can see a map here of the state of California. There are approximately 1,100 data points on that map. The red colors are chrome 6 values in public supply wells that exceed the currently proposed maximum contaminant level for chrome 6 of 10 parts per billion. They are not uniformly distributed throughout the state. You can see that they're concentrated in certain areas depending upon geology in the coast range of Northern California, where you have mafic and serpentine rocks. Alluvial deposits eroded from those rocks tend to have higher chromium concentrations. In the deserts, the Mojave area and the Colorado deserts, where you have older groundwater that's alkaline, has reacted significantly with the geological materials, some of which do actually contain chromium. You also have high concentrations of chromium. Throughout the state as a whole, about 7% of the public supply wells exceed that proposed limit. In the Mojave area, about 15% of the public supply wells exceed that limit. When PG&E comes to you and they talk about existing natural chromium in the Mojave area, they're looking at these areas up here, the Victorville Fan, Sheep Creek Fan, maybe out in the Morongo Basin, over in that area, the Surprise Springs area, where you have certain geology, where you have older groundwater, and it's reacted significantly to liberate chrome 6 within the water. So they're telling you the truth when they say there's high concentrations of naturally occurring chrome 6. In some cases, they can actually exceed 50 parts per billion, which would be the current California maximum contaminant level for chromium. When the citizens of Hinkley come to you and tell you that no concentrations of chrome 6 in natural background in the Mojave area and the Hinkley Valley are probably low, they're looking at this part of the map, and you see the floodplain aquifer along the Mojave River. Recently recharged groundwaters from surface flows in the Mojave River, circumneutral pH is relatively young in age. None of those values are exceeding 2 micrograms per liter. So it's a large contrast. That contrast is a function of geology, hydrology, and geochemistry. The Hinkley Valley area is located right about here. Much of the water in the Hinkley Valley is within the floodplain aquifer. One might expect low concentrations of chromium. Some of the Hinkley Valley is bonded on either side by geologic rocks which may contain chrome. And so we understand the processes that enable chromium to get in the groundwater. Much of this work here, detailing high concentrations of chromium in groundwater and detailing low concentrations of chromium in groundwater as a result of my work over the past 15 years. It's the interfingering of the geology and its combination with hydrology and geochemistry in the Hinckley Valley area that is really leading to the need for this proposal and this study. And there's nothing that we don't know in terms of the processes. It's just understanding what's happening in this local area that we need to have more data and have the study to address. The purpose of the study is twofold. First off, to evaluate the occurrence of natural and anthropogenic or man-made chrome 6 in the Hinckley Valley. Secondly, to estimate the background chrome 6 concentrations up gradient near the plume margins and down gradient from the Mac plume near Hinckley, California. That differs a little bit from the previous 2007 study, and that it's been divided into two portions. The first part, occurrence of natural and anthropogenic chromium, maybe you could sum it up in what's natural, what's PG&E's responsibility. And the second part, actually putting quantitative numbers in a rigorous fashion on there that you might use for regulatory purposes. Depending upon the results here, that would influence the results that you use there and your need for that level of quantification. The study differs from the 2007 study also in the nature of the study area. It's slightly larger. It includes more areas outside the map stream, also to the north, to Harper Dry Lake. But background includes this area here. There is a recognition by all the parties involved that the study area has certain geologic and hydrologic complexities, and it may differ in different areas. You have a northern area, you have a western area, you have an eastern area, and areas where groundwater is immediately recharged by the Mojave River. It is very likely and very possible that the background chrome 6 numbers in each of those areas may be somewhat different. That said, it's complex. It may be more complex than you'd like to hear. You'd like, obviously, your one number to work with. That'd be much easier. But it's not unknowable. This is something that we can work with and we can put numbers on that can be managed and worked with. So our goal is actually to produce usable, understandable, unbiased, and actionable science-based work. And that is important to know. Science-based is the theme for this project. There are other ways that one could go about managing this plume. It could be engineering-based, what can we clean up? It could be policy-based. You know, what is the current MCL that we need to shoot for? But science, the more you know about the problem, the more you know about the study area, the better chance you have of making a correct decision that will stand the test of time into the future. There are some ancillary benefits to this study, other things that will happen that are good. We have the opportunity to look at other trace elements that are present within the Hinckley Valley. You've talked a lot, I'm sure, about manganese, iron, and arsenic issues in the Hinckley Valley related to the in-situ reduction activities by PG&E. We'll have an opportunity to look at that. I know there are some uranium issues out there also. As part of this study, we have looked at the concerns of the community, and the CAC and other community groups out there, and we have made sure that the inorganic constituents of interest to them have been included within this study. I have not extended the scope to include some of the organic constituents that are of interest to various people in the community, nor, with the exception of uranium, have I expanded the scope of the study to include some of the radiological aspects of it. So we are focused primarily on the chrome 6, the chromium, and some of these other trace elements in terms of how they help us understand the system and how they help us understand the reactions that are going on within the system. We worked with the CAC, Project Navigator, the Regional Water Quality Control Board, PG&E, and the consultants to provide data that will address other issues of concern within the Hinckley Valley. Some of those may be regulatory. I've noticed in the past year the focus of those issues change rapidly with time as different issues come to the forefront. But good, high-quality data that are unbiased can serve the background study, and they may serve helping with the decision-making process on many of the other issues that come in front of the board. The scope of the proposal includes an evaluation, eight tasks. It includes an evaluation of existing data. That's task one. We're really looking for trends in the data, how things are changing with time. Those data are available, and they should be looked at. Sample collection analysis of rock and alluvium. If the area is geologically sufficiently high in chromium in order to produce high chrome 6 concentrations in groundwater, we should be able to measure that. We should be able to see it. Sample collection and analysis of water. This is one portion of this study that differs greatly from the 2007 background study, in that we have a much wider suite of analytical and isotopic constituents to help us understand not only how the water is moving through the system, but where it came from, how rapidly it flows through the system, how it reacts with the minerals that are within the system, and to produce the groundwater that we see. Evaluation of local conditions. I spoke with that already about different subareas within the system that may have different components, different background chrome 6 concentrations. We're aware of that, and we intend to address that. Evaluation of groundwater movement. I'm primarily a hydrologist by training. Any of the geochemistry that I do, I want to make certain that the interpretations are within the range of hydrologic possibility, and that we can be sure that if we're saying water came from a certain area, that we've looked at the groundwater flow and hydraulic properties to make sure that we're consistent to the extent possible with that in our interpretations. Again, I've talked about these two issues being separated now in terms of the occurrence of anthropogenic chromium and the estimation of background chrome 6 concentrations. And we have a task in there where we look specifically at the fate of chromium within the IRZ. The next several slides will focus in on some of these individual tasks, give you a little bit more detail in terms of how we intend to pursue that and the issues that we're after. Task 1 mineralogy, or task 2 mineralogy, if you're looking at an area and you're saying there's background chromium, there should be chromium in the rock, there should be chromium in the alluvium, we should be able to measure that. In the Mojave Desert, on the Sheep Creek Fan, where I've worked for a good part of these last 10 or 15 years, we've seen chromium substituted within actinolite within the Blue Ridge on the San Gabriel Mountains there. It's abundant. It's massive. It's actually substituted within a big green rock. If you climb that mountain, if you like to do that sort of thing and hike, you'll actually see a 30-foot or so high wall of this type of material up there. Chromium is in the part per thousand range within that rock, and it's easily weathered. Once it's chromium, once that rock weathers, the chromium comes up first, you can pick up that rock and you can crush it in your hand. In contrast, in the Sacramento Valley and some of the areas that I mentioned in Northern California, and actually in most places, chromite is really the source of chromium. Chromite is really the source of chromium. It tends to be abundant in those areas, but in terms of being what you see, it's not a massive rock. It's finely disseminated. These are very, very small crystals. These are scanning electron photomicrographs of chromium. Where it occurs is pure chromium oxide, but it tends to be resistive to weathering. Whoops, let's back up a little bit. Here's a piece of chromite that's unweathered. It can be very abundant in the rock, but if it's not weathering, it's not getting in the groundwater. Here's chromite that is weathered. You can look at it. You can physically see it's weathered. It's got dissolution pits on it. It's got craters. It's actually dissolving, and that would be a case where the chromite is contributing chromium to groundwater. So we can look at that. We can visually see. We can make measurements that are actually very understandable to people involved in the study in terms of what's happening. Isotopic tracers of water and chromium. We will not want to know where the water came from. Did it flow underneath the compressor station? We want to know how fast it flowed. Is it reasonable that areas to the north of Red Gap that appear to have chromium now, could they have originated from the Mojave River within the time frame of the release to have moved that far within the groundwater system? And is the chromium that we're looking at, is it natural or is it related to PG&E? There are geochemical tools that we can use to look at that. Oxygen 18 and deuterium are part of the water molecule. They tell us where the water originated from. Virtually all the water that we see in Mojave Valley, from the data that we have so far at present, was sourced as recharge from the Mojave River. That really shouldn't be any surprise to anybody sitting in this room that you've had a lot of experience in dealing with this particular issue. Dissolved atmospheric gases, they'll help us understand how that water got in at the Mojave River and confirm that it is indeed Mojave River water that was recharged while the river was flowing when it was cold. It leaves a very distinct signature with the water. Tracers of the age of groundwater recharge. Tritium, naturally occurring, but its presence in the environment was increased with the atmospheric testing of nuclear weapons. I'll show you a slide on that. It corresponds nicely to the time frame of release of the chromium from the compressor station. Helium-3, a little bit more refined measurement of age dating. Tritium will tell us what water was recharged after 1952. With the helium-3, we may be able to get plus or minus 2 to 5 years on the age of that water. Dissolved industrial gases, chlorofluorocarbons and SF6, they'll actually extend our dating back a little bit further, and they'll give us confirmation on some of the tritium age dating numbers that we have and help us analyze mixtures. Carbon-14, very useful tool to look at older groundwaters which may have predated releases from the compressor station. Tracers of rock-water interaction. Is the water really reacting with the rock? We can see that in the chemistry data, and we can see it with some of the isotopic data that we intend to collect. And chromium isotopes. Chromium exists, has 4 naturally occurring isotopes in nature. We use 2 of those to help us determine not so much the source of the chromium. There is no magic bullet out there. I'm not promising anybody an easy and simple answer. But they're useful to help us understand processes. Once you understand processes, you have a better understanding of where the chromium may have come from. And this is data from Topok, California. Topok is the next compressor station east of the Hinckley site. And there they had a background concentration of about 35 parts per billion chromium. What I want you to see here is near the plume margin, here and here, we actually have chromium concentrations that were below the background, but they appear to have originated from the releases at the chromium at the compressor station. So that background number in and of itself may not tell the complete story. We're aware of this. We have a tool to look at this. And that background number may differ from areas, but even when we have a background number, there may be areas below natural background that are clearly attributable to the compressor station. We're aware of that, and we have the tools to look for that. Age dating parameters in stream flow. You've lived out here a long time. You know what the Mojave River looks like most of the time. It's a dry, stand channel. It flows only intermittently. The biggest flows, 1938, 1969, 1993, and 2005, are shown here. And the chromium releases, 1952 to 1964, occurred about in here during an extended dry period in the Mojave River. We can actually use that to our advantage. Most of the water that we'll be mixing with recharged in 1969. We can identify that water. We can identify its age. We can see how it reacted with what was in the ground and how it moved forward through the system. Having discrete packages of recharge actually helps us in this case in terms of how we're going to handle the numbers and how we're going to work with them. So it's to our advantage. The USGS has worked out here for a large number of years. We have a regional groundwater flow model that was developed as part of the adjudication. PG&E also has a groundwater flow model of the Hinckley Valley area that's very, very detailed. We're proposing to use that PG&E model to help us understand how water flows through the system. And we're going to look at that model. We already have done some discussion on this to see if that model is suitable, if it would be upgraded to answer very specific questions that we need to make sure that the way we interpret data from task 1, 2, and 3 is consistent with the hydrology of the system as well as we understand it based on groundwater flow models and the hydraulics that we understand within the system. And we're to use that to estimate historic groundwater levels in the past, in that period when groundwater wasn't monitored very closely, when the chromium releases first occurred in 1952 up to 1964, when groundwater recharge occurred in 1968. How did that groundwater move? How did chromium within the groundwater how was that transported within the system? Those are questions that we can actually look at and we can address using this technology. We're going to couple the groundwater flow model to a particle tracker, and we're going to use that in the fashion that was done in the USGS regional model to help us evaluate the movement of water and make sure that the tracer data are consistent with our understanding of hydraulics and therefore with our understanding of the potential movement of chromium within the system. Task 8. We're going to look at the fate of chromium during and after in-situ reduction. Some of this work has already been done at Topok and at Hinckley by PG&E. We're going to do it a little bit differently. We're going to use actually a controlled laboratory experiment. We're going to use isotopically labeled chromium. I mentioned that already that chromium exists in 4 naturally occurring isotopes. We're going to take the 2 less abundant isotopes that we don't have to deal with in our samples, and we'll spike those samples with that. We'll find out where the chromium ends up on the exchange sites on the surfaces of the mineral grains. With time, is it increasingly incorporated into those mineral grains, becoming increasingly less reactive in time? We don't know. We'll find out. And then, when the system reoxygenates, does that chromium reoxidize, become chrome 6, and is potentially mobile back into the system? And we have a discussion of how we're going to do that. One of the key changes in that is we're going to be using artificial substrates as controls so that we can eliminate some of the noise that you see in this data that was collected previously. This is going to be very delicate work, and we have to make sure that we have the best possible samples and best possible analytics that we can do in order to be successful with this. We're working together. This is not a single... Thank you. Working together, this is not a single project being done solely by USGS. Initially, we'll work with the entire CAC to develop task-specific work plans. We'll work very closely in the field with PG&E for drilling the well installation where required. USGS will take the lead on rock and mineral analysis. Sample collection from PG&E monitoring wells, they do that better than anybody. They're their wells. We will be on site with them to make sure that we have a smooth exchange of the water back and forth. We'll split samples. Some will be analyzed by PG&E. They have certain regulatory needs and requirements that they have to meet in order for what you have established for them. And many of the very sophisticated analyses can only be done at USGS labs to make sure that we get the best quality data throughout. These data and these results will be updated to the CAC and the technical working group on a monthly basis. During that time, we will evaluate the data constantly, and we'll provide that data will inform our activities and our work plans so that we can, as we step through the study, we're constantly learning, constantly doing things better, and constantly evaluating the data. Within this step, Project Navigator will talk later, but we've discussed about the need for ongoing action with the data. If we discover something that's important to the activities at the site, we don't want to see PG&E or the community or the board spend resources needlessly. So to the extent that we need to action on our results, we're able to do that. Ultimately, though, it is a USGS report and USGS interpretation, and I am the person who's finally responsible for that. The last year of the study, I anticipate that there'll need to be some explanation of the results and some evaluation in terms of how those results can best be implemented. And so we won't just walk away. There's an opportunity in there for us to continue to participate in the process and continue to evaluate the data, working with the community, working with PG&E, and working with your staff to make this ultimately very successful. Again, I promised you a lot, but I don't want to promise you everything, and I can't. I can't identify the source of chrome 6 in every landowner's well out there. There's just too many wells to sample. I can't do that. I can't promise that. And many of the tools that we have actually work better in an aggregated style rather than on an individual well on a single data point. And I want you to be aware of that. Also, it's not a definitive hydrologic study, and it's not intended to be. There are hydrologic questions and issues that are out there that go beyond the scope of the background study and need to be addressed by PG&E and by their consultants, independent of the background study. What we're really after with the hydrologic data that we collect and the data from the local sub-areas is information to make sure that we interpret the data correctly relative to the background study. In terms of the nuts and bolts of the timeline of the study, this gives you an idea of the tasks. There are interim reports and products that will be produced so that we're not working in a vacuum with the entire community and with the regional board. We intend to give you some things to work with and talk about and think about. And it's a complex study. As I mentioned, the last year of the study is really technical assistance and support. The bulk of the study will be done in 4 years. In FY13, we've actually already proceeded with much of that work that's outlined there. The costs, it's not a cheap study. Here are the costs. We've actually had two levels of costs prepared for PG&E within Task 3, where we collect 60 samples versus 90 samples. Obviously, 90 is better than 60, giving you more information, and we've had that discussion in terms of what we need and what has to be done for the people. In the Valley, USGS is a funding participant within the study, contributing federal matching dollars to make sure that this is successful and make sure the work goes on time, on schedule, to completion. So that's my presentation. I'm ready for questions if you have them, and from the community and from the board. Thank you.
So what I'd like to do now is take questions and comments first from the public, and then if that's agreeable with board members from the board.
Thank you.
Thank you.
So I have one card for this item. If there are others, please bring them forward. Billy Hernandez, former CAC member.
Hi, my name is Abel Hernandez. I'm a former CAC member. My biggest issues all the time with this stuff is that I've learned a lot in the last year and a half with Mr. Zbecki and all the technical meetings that we went to. As Lisa said, the natural chromium, the minimum was like 1.2 to 3.1 for most of the places. But every time I turn around, it seems like there's things that, like they're trying to not let the plume grow. If there's a spot that's growing more than 3.1, they don't want to attach the plume lines correctly. To the southwest where I was living, my well ended up being 4.1, and then on Hinckley Road it was 7.1. And it's just a bubble. If you look at Mr. Zbicki's map over there, it's just a bubble to the southwest. And my biggest problem with that is that the original order was that anything that was over 3.1, the plume was supposed to be connected. In my opinion, from the compressor station, it should go to that big bubble right there and then back over to the other one. And what that does, it makes the plume bigger, but it increases the volume of people that are accepted in the criteria that's important to the community members. I built my house out there in 2010. In 2010, my property was assessed by the assessor at 598. Then it dropped down to 294. And last year, it dropped down to $47,815. Financially, a lot of people in Hinckley are facing those kind of financial problems. And when they eschew the lines and it doesn't include everybody, it becomes a financial burden to the people out there. I was in a situation where my well was deep, and for over 2.5 years, I didn't fit their criteria, but they were buying pieces of property all the way around me. And my well was deep, so I told PG&E I was going to drill another well at 130 feet because mine was about 250. Then they offered to put in 3 monitoring wells, and one of my specifications was that one of them had to be between 100 and 130 feet. That's the one that came up at 4.1 and put me into the program. This is, if you would handle that to that, for them, they can have that. That will show you the county assessors that it's official that it was only at $47,815 for this last year, 2013. It's a 4,800 square foot home that was brand new. It was paid for when I built it, and I had to turn in paperwork to the bank, Union Bank, to be able to get an equity line. The only thing that they would give me because of the stigmatism that goes with Hinckley was a loan for $150,000. But what they were going to do last year, well, they were going to cancel that because of the value of my property. So there's another well to the east that is 2,700 feet away from the nearest monitoring wells. And it has to be 2,600 feet before they can draw the plume line. So that one's another well that doesn't let the plume grow to the east. And those are kind of loopholes. And those are the things that I'm here to say, you know, PG&E petitions, and a lot of times they get their way, but it's affecting people. So anything over 3.1 should be connected, and then it allows other people to be in this program, and that's what I'm after here tonight. I mean, I spent a lot of money to be a person that wanted to live in Hinckley, and that dream of mine got destroyed, but I still care about Hinckley, and that's why I'm still coming to these meetings. And I learned a lot with Mr. Uzbecki, and I'm hoping that they keep telling me that the rocks towards the southeast are doing this chromium. I don't particularly believe that that's the issue. And once they do this testing over there, I think they're going to find out that rock might create some chromium, but it might be at 1.2. It ain't at 7.1 and 4.1. And a lot of the injection and the programs that they're doing with this washing machine type of stuff that they're doing, it could be shoving things one way or another. And if you look at his map, right above the line there, there's a finger that's shooting out that way that we've been arguing for the last year. You know, that they put a certain rose that they were injecting, and they're supposed to be coming a wall, but it's gotten through there. And us as a community, you know, no engineer can tell you 100% that this is what it is down there. So there's always that opportunity for doubt, a pathway or something that's escaping. And one of the presentations that Lisa did last year was that one of their wells was not working correctly for quite some time. And that's how that finger got started and went that way. And that was very logical to me. So I'm out here just, again, trying to connect the dots for people that might be out of the program, that they should have the eligibility to have some kind of meeting the criteria that they need to meet, you know, because to invest so much money and then have it just deflate because, you know, I didn't do anything wrong, but it all just went to heck. So thank you very much, and I appreciate your time.
Thank you, Billy. I have a few more cards. The next one is Kevin Sullivan, PG&E.
Hi, I'm Kevin Sullivan, the project manager with PG&E, and I just wanted to just take a moment to thank Dr. Uzbecki for his work over the last year. It has been a year. It was last January that we started meeting as a TWG. We've met at least monthly. In addition to this was the year that I finally memorized my Southwest frequent flyer number. It's been a lot of work that's gone into this, and I think it's been beneficial. Certainly from the scientific perspective, there's been a lot of good exchange of ideas. I also believe from the community perspective, I think we've set up some forums for dialogue where I think we've learned how to, you know, the cliche of disagree without being entirely disagreeable. I would encourage the board to support Dr. Uzbecki in this work. You know, I think he said it pretty well. You know, this is one of the big pieces that we're going to have to deal with, and that is the science. You know, we'll be back at other times, I'm sure, to talk about the engineering of the cleanup, and we'll be back to talk about the policy of the cleanup, and those are very important questions. But this, I think, gives us the solid foundation that we're all looking for, which is the best possible knowledge. The questions are hard. We've known that. You've heard us parade up here over the last year or more talking about how hard the questions are and how legitimate people can look at the same set of data and draw, you know, different conclusions. I feel very strongly that this is a good path forward for us to take. It takes a long time. We worked really hard, but good science takes time. And so, you know, in spite of the time and, frankly, in spite of the cost, I'd encourage you all to support this effort.
Thank you, Kevin. Next, I have Darren Banks.
Chairman, board members, thank you. I also, as a CAC, we fully support the study as it sits as a whole, as long as it stays as our last TWG meeting. We have confidence that Dr. Uzbecki is going to do a good job and finally something that we feel we can trust as opposed to other options. And I asked the board also to support the study completely, and during that time, there's still a lot of work to do. I mean, we spent a lot of time working on this study and figuring out what's important to find out, to answer all the questions that we possibly can. And during that time, we've made agreements in the TWG, and so I hope that PG&E and the Water Board, I hope we can keep to all those agreements. And you know, specifically one, the CAC feels, and we appreciate the fact that we're being able to learn along with these people that are much more educated and Doc, much more intelligent than I, of course. But for instance, Project Navigator is going to an agreement with PG&E and the Total Working Group be part of the mapping process of the study, which is going to be vital for the community and for the CAC to be able to have them come back and explain all this very technical, very confusing things to us, so we can talk about this to the community so we all better understand. So, Project Navigator has a role in it. The CAC has a role in it. The USGS has a role in it. Your staff has a role in it. We, as part of the study, the CAC would feel comfortable that, or like to request that somebody from the Victorville staff be able to be more hands-on and be here more often. We don't understand why it's not possible to have somebody from your side there seeing what's going on. I feel like you guys would have more of an understanding too. Even if it's somebody more local, whether it's Victorville staff or somebody that can be here for part, and see the wells drilled or just the progression of the study. More of a hands-on during this time period. So thank you very much.
Thank you, Darren. Next, I have Movita Hernandez, former Hinckley resident.
Good evening. Happy New Year. Thank you for coming out to see us yet again. My name is Movita Hernandez. I am a former Hinckley resident. We were forced to move due to the contamination in the waters, and we now reside in Barstow, California. I actually have a question for Dr. Uzbeki. I think he's been waiting for a question here. And I apologize. I may have asked this about you before. I think I understand that chromium 6 was not tracked as a constituent way back when, and that you do have tracking levels on the water level, the water flow, and then current tracking levels on chromium 6. Would you be able to explain in layman's terms how you will use that data to arrive at a conclusion of whether or not it is naturally occurring or that it belongs to the PG&E discharge, if you would? Thank you.
I guess to answer that question, I'd almost have to go back and redo the presentation, but it really comes down to this scope of work. We've divided the issue into a series of questions, and as we answer each of those questions, ultimately we'll answer the final question that you have there. But what we're going to do is look at the rock. We're going to look at the alluvium. We're going to determine if chromium is present there. If it's reasonable to expect that material would produce some of the chromium concentrations that you're seeing. We're going to look at the water, and we're going to determine if, on the basis of what we see in the water, is that rock dissolving, and based on the mineralogic evidence. Because you could have a lot of chromium within the rock, as I illustrated with some of those pictures there, but that chromium may be static and may not be dissolving, so we need to know that. The other important piece of information is hydrologic, and it's how fast is that water moving? How did it get from the river through the valley? Did it pass underneath the compressor station, or did it go some other way? If in 1968, during that period of high recharge, after many years of no recharge, we can evaluate and determine that a parcel of water at a given location moved beneath the compressor station, it may well have been exposed to chromium that was released from the compressor station at that time. We'll do that with a combination of the tracer data that we have embedded within the study, both the age dating information to tell us how fast the water is moving, the stable isotope information to tell us where it came from, the chromium isotope information to tell us the nature of the chromium, what processes it's undergone, and with groundwater flow model to evaluate, is that all reasonable with respect to how we understand the hydrology of the system? And you know, I guess that's the best answer that I can give you in a minute or two. But yeah, thank you for the question. It actually really sums up the study very nicely.
Thank you, Dr. Rusticky. The last card I have on this item is from Ian Webster, IRP manager.
Good evening, board members. My name is Ian Webster. I am the IRP manager. IRP manager represents the technical interests of the community, interfaces between PG&E and the community, and basically attempts to describe technical topics to sometimes a lay audience such that the understanding of the community is enhanced and the project can move ahead at a faster pace. I'll be brief after that, these remarks. I also personally, as the IRP manager, very much endorse John's work, USGS's work going ahead. I think you as board members actually face a pretty unique situation here where all members coming to the podium from different stakeholder perspectives are actually agreeing on something. And we think this project is a pivotal thing in moving the Hinkley solution ahead. The other item that wasn't discussed previously tonight, and I'll make remarks later on tonight about this, is the effort that went into the past year in reaching scope of work or work plan agreement. It was substantial. And I think all parties, including the community, USGS and PG&E, need to be congratulated at sticking with a very difficult task. One item that was discussed, however, during that past year was the need for the USGS to remain in a key decision-making role. Data will flow to Dr. Rusticky and his staff for analysis resulting in decision-making. The Water Board can then consider. I'll also discuss these remarks later on tonight. But that decision-making aspect is very important of the process behind the actual science of the background study. Thanks for attention.
Thank you, Ian. With that, Chair Pumphrey and members of the board, questions, comments?
Can I sort of take this moment just maybe clarify something that Ian said, because we've had this discussion before as far as the decision-making. We're in a role where we can collect the science, we can interpret it, we can identify pieces of information that are important to the community, to PG&E, and the progress of the study. The decision-making responsibility still rests with the board and your staff. And so we're all collectively very much in agreement on that. And interesting and important scientific information, it's my job to bring that forth. It's the TWG's job to discuss it and then decide what actions are appropriate to bring forth the Regional Water Quality Control Board. And the decision-making still remains to you. We're solely a scientific agency, not a regulatory, or we have no land management responsibilities.
Thank you.
What I'd like to do is just sort of look up and down the table and start just with questions, and then we'll come back around for comments.
No questions.
Dr. Rusticky, on your last slide that you showed, if you could forward to that.
That would be the funding slide? This
yes.
One here?
Yes. Task 3, there's two options there, one for 60 samples and one for 90 samples. Has it been determined which one of those options will be selected?
When we put that together, there was concern on PG&E's part in terms of they didn't want to be in a situation that they would have to go back to their funding mechanisms internally and say, oh, by the way, we need more money. At least if up front we can identify one area where we think we need more money, this would be it. And whether or not, that would be PG&E's decision as to what level they need to pursue that at initially, but at least they are forewarned that as the data come in, data may be more variable than what people expect. We may need greater spatial density in certain areas. So at least there's a forewarning on an upper limit of costs that they might have to deal with.
Okay, thank you.
And to my left, questions.
I have several questions about this one, since the slide is up. Would you be able to, let's say the 60 samples were agreed to, would you be able to adjust the density in certain areas and stay within the 60 sample range and get the greater density where it's needed?
Yeah, that would come kind of in this slide here. We're actually developing task-specific work plans. Currently, the thinking is it will go out in at least two phases, collect samples, see what they look like. Much of the wells that will be identified for that first phase would be coming from information that we get from, say, task one of the project, where we're looking at trends, we're looking at existing data. So task one will inform phase one of task three. When you get the data back from the initial sample round, obviously you're much smarter than you were before you started. So you go back out again and collect areas. You may cluster the data in certain areas, or you may decide that you may need greater aerial coverage. So those decisions are, right now we have a proposal. You're asking questions that are really more at the scope of work level, and so we have to move forward the process to get there.
My other questions are not for the doctor, so perhaps I should wait until we're addressing this more generally, or should I ask them now?
I don't see why we couldn't ask them now.
Okay, thanks. We've heard from Jimmy Hernandez several times about
Billy,
about the fact that his property doesn't seem to get into the program. The boundary doesn't seem to get drawn so that he's included. And I don't think we've ever heard an answer as to why that's true. So I would like to hear somebody tell me that. And the other question that was raised by Darren Banks, who deserves an answer, is can we get more staff to oversee things that are going on the ground?
Sure. And Ms. Kiyamchin, would you like to respond to those?
Yes, I'm going to have Lori and Lisa help and give you a little bit more information about how we are defining the plume boundaries and how we are making decisions about that plume boundary as a response to the CO, which is, I think, some of the questions that have come to date. Regarding the second question, Mr. Sandel, about having more staff working here on it, I'll be talking to Ann. Ann is the lead on this project. And we have, at times, use our victorial staff as technical assistance on this, and we'll likely continue to do so. So I'll have to find a little bit more from what is needed more than the staff that we are devoting to this. So let's see if Lori wants to add to that.
Yeah, this is Lori Kemper. I'm the Assistant Executive Officer at the Water Board. And on the question of staffing, the biggest challenge, because I think Darren deserves an answer, you know, a little bit. I think some of the victual staff sometimes is looking for more information here as well. And one of the biggest challenges is that our victual staff has more work than they can get done. You know, there's a limitation because we have such a huge region and the number of people in that office are overwhelmed with their regular job and tasks of regulating other facilities in the Southern California area. So in my mind, there's really two parts to that question about can we get more staff in the Victorville office to help be on the ground. From my analysis of our resources, we would need another person. You know, we would need a new person in the Victorville office. And being able to hire new staff is a challenge. Even if PG&E is paying for that. I mean, at this point, staffing is reimbursed by PG&E, but in order to have Sacramento allow us to hire people, there has to be that, we have to be able to show that there's enough, you know, there's a commitment from PG&E to pay those salaries and to be able to staff at that level. So that's our current challenge. So at this time, Ann and Lisa are both having their costs reimbursed, and some of our advisory team staff are having their costs reimbursed, but it's that could be a challenge right now in terms of it's basically saying something else isn't going to get done. People are out there on a daily basis watching PG&E's consultants drill wells, or you know, the level of energy that Darren is requesting sounds high to me. I think our staff has been involved in the monthly technical working group meetings, and that would be our intent to continue that level, whether it's monthly or quarterly, to stay on top of the tasks and then do the contract management. So over the phone, working with Uzbeki and the USGS staff on invoice management and things like that. So that's the role we've laid out tonight, is a role as more of a contract manager and a active participant in the technical working groups. So something beyond that would require different sorts of adjustments and decisions about priorities and things that aren't going to get done. So the question that Billy asked about the plume, and board member Sandel asked about, is Billy's house is located in this area over here, and that area is on the other side of the Lockhart Fault, and so Dr. Uzbeki can probably talk a little bit about the science behind that, but what we're seeing in that area, and you can see too that it's quite to the west of the compressor station, and it's almost kind of laterally about the same location. Groundwater from the compressor station is moving primarily north, so there's really no indication that water from the compressor station ever crossed the Lockhart Fault in that direction. And that is why the board and Patty's recent letter identified that area, we do not believe, is coming from, that the chromium in that area is not coming from the discharges historically that occurred at the compressor station. That being said, there are some ongoing investigations related to other anthropogenic sources of chromium that might be in that area. So there's both the potential for high levels naturally occurring because of rock on that side of the Lockhart Fault, but there's also a past dump site that PG&E has done some removal of some inert waste, and there's some additional investigation going on. So there's potential for a different conclusion over there, but for the time being, it's not part of the compressor station's discharge, and the requirements for mapping the plume relate to the discharges that originated from the compressor station. So when Billy asked about why aren't they connected, we're not sure that they're connected actually physically, but they're also not... the requirement for mapping is really related to the historic discharges from the station.
But that area will be included in the USGS study.
Yes, it will be. So we'll get some additional information. So that's one of those things, too, where there'll be things going on the surface that PG&E may be investigating, and then there'll be the study that Dr. Uzbeki is doing, so we'll have additional information for that area. Hope that answers. And then the lines themselves just are not connected because of the distance, because the order requires to connect the lines where the monitoring wells are within a certain distance between each other. So there's a greater distance, an area basically that has less than 3.1 parts per billion in between those two lines. So that's why they're not connected as well.
Anything further, Mr. Sandel?
No, thank you.
Mr. Dias?
Yes, thank you. Dr. Uzbeki, could I ask you a question about the slide that refers to Task 2, mineralogy?
Okay.
Regarding the mineral actinolite, you indicate that chromium is substituted within actinolite. Can you explain what that means?
Well, you have a mineral structure. I can't relate to you the formula for actinolite off the top of my head, but generally these minerals will have a space within the lattice where atoms of iron, manganese, or other metallic ions will fit within there. A certain percentage of those may be chromium. In the case of this rock that we have here, we did a large amount of work on the Sheep Creek Fan a number of years ago, looking for sources of chromium in that area. And when we analyzed this rock and we did a variety of chemical tests and a variety of mineralogic tests on it, we found that this was a rock that actually contained chromium. The concentrations are actually fairly high in the parts per thousand range, not enough to be an ore, but enough that it's consistent with
mafic rock. This is a mafic rock. It also has high concentrations of nickel, which is consistent with that also. And so, as opposed to chromium oxide, or chromite, which is essentially pure chromium oxide, this is a much more complex mineral. Lower concentrations of chromium. It weathers very readily and very easily. But this stuff, where it's weathering, is potentially more potent. So did I give you enough information to answer your question?
Yes, thank you very much.
Okay.
Dr. Horn.
If we could go two slides further down to age dating parameters and stream flow, that one, yeah.
Okay.
Okay. Recognizing that I'm simplifying things dramatically here. Assuming you found levels of chromium 6 that were consistent with the geology, and the water did not have traces of tritium, chlorofluorocarbons, and what does SF stand for?
Sulfur hexafluoride.
That. What would you conclude?
That would be indicative of a water that's background potentially. And in that case, if we've got high concentrations of chromium in the water, we'd certainly like to see at that location high concentrations of chromium in the rock. One of the things we'd also like to see, if it's older water, that it still contains dissolved oxygen. Chrome 6 won't exist in solution unless there's dissolved oxygen. We would also like to see that the pHs are elevated. And as groundwater flows through the aquifer, these silicate minerals contain the bulk of that material, dissolve. They consume hydrogen ion. That causes the pH to go up. As the pH goes up, what actually happens is that the chromium that is sorbed on the surfaces of these mineral grains comes into solution in the water. And so we're not looking for necessarily a strict decision rule, but we're looking for samples that fit our understanding of the hydrologic and geochemical processes that we have.
Okay, you gave me a way more complicated answer than I was.
Sorry about that. I guess the answer was yes. That's probably what you wanted to hear.
Well, I guess what I'm trying to drive at is that these tracer chemicals, the tritium and the CFCs, that's in combination with the geology, but it's a key hint as to whether the chromium you're finding there is background or from
exactly
the
right.
compressor station.
And that is one thing that we have as a tool embedded in this study that was not in the previous work, so we expect it to be very useful.
Okay, and then I understand that on Sheep's Creek Fan, one of the things that you found there, I believe this is correct, was that when there was high levels of nitrate in the water, that mobilized chromium as well?
No, that's not quite correct.
Okay.
What we actually saw was that the high level of nitrate, you're referring to the dairy at A&H,
right.
And we saw that there was naturally occurring chromium in the subsurface. That water was washed through by, in this case, dairy wastewater. That dairy wastewater would have a very high organic carbon content, and one would expect the chrome 6 would be rapidly reduced to chrome 3. The other thing that dairy wastewater contains is a lot of nitrate. And this is a microbial process. The microbes that reduce chrome 6 to chrome 3 also reduce nitrate. And if, nitrate is present in the milligram per liter range, chromium is present in the microgram per liter range, so it's about 1,000 times more abundant. Those bacteria are adapted to utilize a nitrate source as food also. It's more abundant. They'll go after that first. As long as there's nitrate still in the water, they'll consume the nitrate, and the nitrate is all gone. Then they turn to the chromium as an energy source, and then they reduce the chromium. So again, a little bit more complex answer than
okay.
what you probably wanted. But
so in the presence of the nitrate, the reaction of reduction of chromium 6 to chromium 3 happens more slowly.
Yes, it's inhibited. Correct.
Okay, thank you.
Any other questions from members of the board? I have no questions, so what I'd like to do is to turn to comments from board members, Mr. Jardine.
Yes, I feel this study needs to proceed. I think it's valuable. It's impartial, independent, and in my eyes, I think we need to support the 90 samples in task three and go for the higher order, by realizing it will change the study, and I think it's valuable for the community, for us.
Thank you.
Ms. Cox.
I agree with Commissioner Jardine. More data is good. The work of the USGS in the Mojave Desert is absolutely renowned. Dr. Isbicki is, you know, like a god in our area of water science. Having him do a study like this that is supported by all of the various interest in this area, I think is just huge. It's an unbiased scientific analysis that at the end of the day, you know, will provide many of the answers, not all of the answers. The answers that do come out of this study may not thrill some parties versus other parties, but it will be scientifically sound, and I think a study that we can all rely on. I strongly support this.
Thank you.
Dr. Horn.
Dr. Isbicki, where have you been all these years?
I've been actually out in the desert for 30 of those years.
It has been so frustrating to try to solve this problem because so often we haven't had all the information we want. Someone says tomatoes, someone says tomatoes. I mean, it's so it is wonderful to have your study. And as Board Member Cox said, it's not going to give us 100% certainty, but it will help answer a lot of the questions that everyone has had in trying to solve this problem. It's going to be tough, everybody in the room, to be patient, to wait for 4 years for the results of this study. So we're all going to have to hang in there a little while longer, but it will be worth it. I just want to reassure everybody that this board has had a lot of experience in basing its policy decisions on expert, credible scientific studies. We have just done this up in Lake Tahoe to improve the clarity of Lake Tahoe. That was work that was conducted by scientists mostly at University of California, Davis, for over 10 years. Everyone had to be patient, and it was tough waiting for all those years for all that information to come in. But then when we were able to make a decision based on that scientific, that credible scientific information, it was a good decision. So we've done it before, we can do it again, and I'm looking forward. I wish I could snap my fingers and make 4 years go by. Thank you.
Thank you.
Mr. Dias.
Yes, I support moving forward with the background study with USGS.
Thank you.
I love going last. There's nothing left to say. It's great. Thank you.
Thank you.
Well, I am mindful of the slide with the giant thumbs up. sort of a hint, kind of a presage. And so I take it that no actual resolution from the board is required. I hope you clearly have a sense of how the board feels, which is this. And thank you very much. I look very, very much looking forward to the results as they unfold. Thank you.
Thank you all very much. We'll be actually working tomorrow beginning at 2:30 to kick off the study. PG&E has data ready to transfer to us, and the Water Board staff will be there to help move things along with the Citizens Group and Project Navigator. Thank you all.
Excellent. Thank you very much.